Hello and welcome to the BizNews News Wrap. It's Thursday, the 24th of October. I'm Lucy Ferreira and I'll be taking you through the top news items on BizNews today. We've curated the best clips from the most important stories, and if you'd like to view the full interviews, you can find them on biznews.com, TV and radio. Coming up, we've got a rather juicy lineup ahead of us. First off, famously outspoken global entrepreneur Rob Herzog holds back nothing regarding the controversial Springbok private equity deal, which is then followed by equally direct advocate Glynis Breytenbach with a scathing indictment of Justice Minister Thembi Simelane amidst widespread calls for her resignation. And then Tesla results in focus with our partners from Bloomberg. And lastly, but certainly not least, Russian historian Irina Filatova unpacks Putin's message from the BRICS summit to the West. We are here, and now you have to listen to us. First up, we have Alec Hogg joined by Rob Herzog on the proposed private equity deal involving South Africa's beloved Springbok rugby team, which has ignited widespread controversy. SA Rugby's plan to sell a 20% stake to Akilee Sports Group for $75 million is meant to boost financial stability and expand the team's global reach. However, critics argue that the deal lacks transparency, may unfairly benefit investors, and could lead to a loss of local control over the iconic Springbok brand. Herzog has an extensive background in sports, media, private equity, and finance.
Why do we need a partner? Why do we need money? Once you justify a reason, this is why we need the money, we need to expand the brand, this is the kind of partner we need, then you look around and you say, who are the best partners in the market? And you hire a specialized professional investment banker. You can hire Investec, you can hire RMB, there's some very good people around. Or Goldman Sachs, you know, Richard Nodder, South African's top four of Goldman Sachs worldwide. And you could even get them to do it for free because it's a national asset. And they value the Springbok brand, SARU, the valuation of the commercial entities. And then they say, right, we'd like to find a partner for 20% of this business at this valuation range. That's how you do it. And then you call up the top people and say, would you be interested? And on the basis of one or two people being interested, you begin the negotiation and you end up with a deal that makes sense. This hasn't happened. This is amateurs, absolute amateurs, you know, who've been brought someone on a plate by Eddie Jordan, who I know very well. And let's just ask a question of Eddie's role. Firstly, I've never in my life seen a fee of 10% on a transaction. Never.
Wow.
As a pure introduction, you get 0.5 to 1%. It was a pure introduction. Hi, Saru. Let me introduce you to the Akilees. Great friends of mine, smart guys. I want 0.5%. Maybe I get 1%. If you actually negotiate the deal, and I don't know who he was representing. Was he representing Saru Akilee? Nobody's telling me. Sounds like he was just in the middle. You get maybe 2 to 3 or maybe 4%. And on a massive complicated deal, maybe 5%. Jordan is getting 10%. For what? Who's he representing? That alone makes me think there's something that SARU either amateurs or doing something illegal. It's one of the two. Then you get into the detail, okay? And this is where you sort of say, well, hang on, didn't someone buy into the All Blacks? And you have a look. Silver Lake. Silver Lake did a deal with the All Blacks at a valuation, I think, was $2.4 billion, $3.5 billion New Zealand, okay, for a minority stake. Okay? So keep that number in mind. This is all the wrong way around, amateur handling, badly constructed. It's a terrible deal. I had a look at it properly yesterday. It's a terrible deal. But the most telling document that everyone should read is this letter from all the unions to SARU detailing what's wrong with the deal. And they did it in a very polite way. You know, doubtful transaction, rationale, and partner. Well, read between the lines. Why are they doing the deal? commercial revenue growth. Wasserman is already engaged to expand sponsorship and global market access. So why are they getting Ackley in? And on and on and on. Everything is in this letter. This letter is, just read it and you'll get exactly what's wrong with this deal. So congratulations, Gayton McKenzie. Gayton McKenzie called Saru and said, do not do the meeting this week, delay it. Which is exactly what a minister should be doing. It's exactly what the Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture should be doing. Having a look and saying, all is not right in the state of Denmark. And it's a quote, by the way, for those who don't know. And all is not right here. We need transparency. We need to have a closer look. And we need to find out what the hell happened and what is going on. Because this is an absolute joke of a deal.
And now calls for the resignation of Justice Minister Thembisa Malane are growing after her controversial dealings with VBS Bank coming under scrutiny. DA spokesperson on justice, Advocate Glynis Breitenbach, has raised concerns over conflicts of interest involving Simelane, accusing her of unethical behaviour during her time as the mayor of Polokwane, and suggesting that her current position at the helm of the justice system jeopardises the integrity of an ongoing investigation. In an interview with Alec Hogg this morning, Breitenbach outlined the dodgy dealings, arguing why Simelane must step down while investigations unfold.
Ms. Simelane has done a couple of things that are a little dodgy that should concern us all. When she was the mayor of Polokwane, she entered into what she calls a loan with a fellow who has now been debarred and fined for all kinds of nefarious and dodgy dealings with VBS. At the time, he was also a service provider to the Polokwane municipality and had facilitated loans or investments from the municipality to VBS, for which he, of course, received, I suppose he'll say it was commission, but it's really just a kickback. But the fact of the matter is, apart from that dodgy dealing, where, of course, there was a conflict of interest when you're the mayor and your municipality is investing and then you get a loan from the service provider on that kind of a basis where you don't have to repay for the next however many years. That should concern everybody and it should concern her. But now she's the Minister of Justice and she's being investigated by the Hawks and it's a prosecutor-led investigation. And if she had any integrity, she would step aside of her own volition. But if she's not going to do that, and clearly she isn't, then the president should, fire her, frankly. That's why she cannot be, at the moment, the Justice Minister. If she's exonerated, mazel tov, wonderful. Go right ahead, come back, do the job, no problem. And if you vacate the position under these circumstances in order for justice to run its course, you come back with your integrity intact. There's no harm done. But under these circumstances, when you cling, like a burr, where it's unbecoming to do so, that doesn't help anybody. It detracts from the credibility of the criminal justice system.
Now to our partners at Bloomberg with Seth Goldstein, Morningstar equity strategist, reacting to Tesla's better-than-expected results. Tesla reported adjusted earnings of 72 cents per share for the quarter, above the average analyst estimate, and reiterated plans to start production of more affordable models in the first half of 2025. Markets reacted positively to Tesla's results, with shares rising 12% overnight.
There was a lot of talk over the last few months here about maybe EVs were falling out of favor, not just Tesla, but overall. We heard from John McNeil yesterday on this very program, who formerly worked for Tesla, formerly worked for Lyft, formerly worked for Cruise, saying that EVs are still being embraced by customers. And at least based on the results we saw out of Tesla today, that seems to be the case.
That's exactly right. We saw Tesla return to growth with deliveries, and we see Tesla is ramping up its new vehicles. So the Cybertruck is going to be ramping up production, and Tesla is still on track to deliver the new, more affordable vehicle in the early part of next year. And then we got a positive announcement from GM yesterday saying that they are still bullish on EVs and that they will be producing them and think they can make them profitable. So, I think what we saw is a temporary slowdown in EV growth, but generally EVs are still growing and consumer demand is still there.
The company Tesla saying that it is on track to open that mega factory over there in Shanghai. And to your point, Seth, on the EV side, particularly on a more affordable EV, they are saying that they plan to launch those affordable models in the first half of 2025.
Another reason why the stock is moving higher in after hours trading is the profitability metrics, right? The gross margin, automotive gross margin, when you back out the regulatory credit, came in at 17.1%. Seth, analysts were looking for something in the neighborhood of 14.9%. How sustainable is this?
I think it's very sustainable. Remember, we had Tesla having multiple headwinds that led to the temporary decline in gross margins for the first half of the year. They were ramping up the Cybertruck. That was still not profitable from a gross margin standpoint. Now we're at break even, likely turning profitable in the coming quarters. We had higher raw materials costs that were still flowing through, and their raw materials costs have been declining. And then we had declining deliveries, meaning higher fixed costs per car included. As Tesla's lowering their costs, and as they've stopped slashing prices like they did last year, we're seeing gross margins start to rebound. And it makes a lot of sense that this is going to be the trend for Tesla going forward, meaning that the first half was likely the bottom.
And lastly, with the first meeting of the newly expanded BRICS group, we're seeing some significant shifts in the geopolitical landscape, especially with the addition of countries like Iran. Joining us this morning to unpack the significance of the summit and how it's shaping the future of international relations is Professor Irina Filatova. And in this conversation with Christine, she delves into how BRICS has evolved from a cooperative, reform-driven group to a bloc increasingly distancing itself from the West.
Now, this summit is the first of the expanded BRICS. What's the biggest difference you've seen since the last summit?
Well, the biggest difference I see is that both China and Russia, but particularly Russia, were pulling the BRICS members, or have been pulling, away from the West. BRICS started as, as a group of countries which is not challenging the West. It just wants to adjust the world, the global economic and political system to suit their interests better. It is going to improve the international relations, regulating system, and there was no idea of the challenge. Now it is all completely different. And I think that the addition of the new members, particularly of such a member as Iran, did push BRICS away from the West and away from the cooperation with the West, in which not every BRICS country is interested and not every BRICS country will agree to that. But the rhetoric has certainly become more anti-Western, more challenging, and to the degree that some countries, like Iran, for example, would like to get rid of that Western-dominated world completely. I mean, Western-dominated international institutions, global economic system, global political system, and so that's the idea. I think that was the result of the enlargement of BRICS.
What would the impact be of a new BRICS financial system on the current global financial system?
So far the West didn't pay much attention to what BRICS does or what resolutions it takes. They want the improved, better system of financial relations. Okay, we can go along with that. We are working on it ourselves. We understand that it is it needs to be reformed. But so far, there was no concrete danger or concrete threat coming from BRICS to the existing financial institutions. Now, BRICS has come with the idea of a common currency. This does not mean that there will be the sort of material expression of currency the dollar notes or whatever. This is a digital currency, and it's not even a currency. It is a system of the digital platform, which will allow transactions between the states without any involvement at all of the American institutions, because the dollar, of course, the strength of the dollar is that it involves all of the deals which are concluded in dollars to go through the American banks through SWIFT. That was the power of the dollar, and that was what the American power actually is based to a very large extent. With this digital platform, it's not the only one that is in the making. There is another one which was actually Americans themselves have been experimenting with such a thing. But of course, it is not quite clear yet how it will operate and to what extent it will endanger the dollar. After all, the dollar system is very strong, and it is only two countries in BRICS which have a real need in the new currency, and that's Russia and Iran, which are under American sanctions.
And that brings us to the end of News Wrap. Remember that you can find all of these interviews and articles on biznews.com, TV, and radio. And don't forget to join Alec Hogg's Biz News Briefing, streaming live tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock. You can find the link on the Biz News homepage.